This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
The dive into this case has been unmeasurable. What I thought was a case that wouldn't interest me at all has now become an obsession. It's funny how that works out. As we wind down our investigation into the vanishing of Judge Joe Crater, we thought it would be beneficial to bring in an expert on the case to educate us all on what researching Crater is like and how it changes you as a person. Tonight, as we end our series, we're joined by Stephen Regal, author of Finding Judge Crater, A Life and Phenomenal Disappearance in Jazz Age New York, to help us dissect August 6, 1930 a little further, as well as Crater's mindset, actions, and perhaps the reasons behind some of those actions. No matter what you think about what happened on August the 6th, I think we can all agree that Judge Joe Crater should go down in history as one of the most influential disappearance cases of all time. For now, let's wrap things up. This is part 3 of our series on Judge Crater.
Having you introduce yourself to our listeners, tell them who you are, what you do for a living, and anything that you want them to know about you.
I'm Steve Regal, the author of Finding Judge Crater. I, by profession, am an attorney, a litigator. I was a prosecutor for a number of years, and I still practice in some of the same courthouses that the judge practiced in, which is kind of neat.
That's awesome.
The whole book idea had gotten started. It turns out this is way back in maybe the early 90s. The New York Times, up to maybe the mid 90s, each year would have a article about the Crater case on the anniversary, August 6th. I started, read that. I think I read maybe a little bit about the case in another magazine. So anyway, I just went down to the New York Public Library on 42nd Street. This was in the days of the card catalog. Looked in the card catalog, and I found that his wife had written memoirs. And then there was this other thing which said collection of articles. And I was curious. The number was to a microfilm, and I got the microfilm and looked through it. And somebody had taken articles on the case over the years, not just at the time of the disappearance, but up through the 1970s. It seemed maybe somebody was planning on writing a book and never got around to it. It was a great introduction because, as I said, these were articles over a 40-year period about the case. And so I got a very kind of long-range view of how the case had played out over the years. And so anyway, I kind of felt like this is my thing to do. This is my project. And that's how I got started.
When you get a 10,000 foot view of a case like this, what was your first thought when you looked at everything before you got into the nitty gritty and got into the details of it, started like kind of chasing down stuff? What was your first thought about this case?
Well, I could tell from this collection of articles that it was still unsolved. Amazingly, it was amazing to me, considering this was, 50 years after his disappearance.
Yeah.
From the articles, I did get the sense that there were all these theories that had sprung up about what the cause of his disappearance was. And I think I was also struck that there didn't seem to be any verified sighting of the judge after he disappeared. The articles, naturally, many of them told about the false sightings, which were legion throughout the country and the world, that people said, oh, I saw him the other day. You know, he sat down in my diner. All of them, it was clear, had not panned out. And I also learned that the New York City Police Department had closed the case as unsolvable or unsolved in 1979. So I was able to get that kind of view of the case. And in addition to my long time interest in history, it just seemed like a kind of a detective story that I'd have to go back. And I also realized from the card catalog and from the microfilm that nobody had written a book that looked at all the evidence over this particularly long period of time.
Yeah.
Nobody had sat down. And so I decided I would try to do a comprehensive account of the case, look at all the evidence that was developed and try to piece it together as to what I think happened.
Do you think that the case was truly unsolvable, or do you think that it should have been solved? Like, do you think that they really just didn't have the ability? Or, as I know you alluded to, like, there's some evidence that you talk about in your book that the grand jury didn't get to see. So I guess my question to you is, if you were investigating this case in 1930, do you think that it was solvable? Do you think they just dropped the ball completely? Or is this just such a weird case that no one was ever going to be able to solve it?
It's a good question. I think it was very difficult to solve it. You had a lot of impediments. There was the title of my book is from a limerick that I refer to, and it ends to the effect of, the mystery is great, but will be much greater if they make a mistake and find Judge Crater. And the reason for that was Tammany Hall. The Tammany Hall, the Democratic political machine, was very much in control of the mayor's office, the district attorney's office. If Crater's disappearance was due to, in some way, to Tammany Hall, that's something they wouldn't want to come out, obviously.
Yeah.
The police department, and I've been through the records, the police NYPD records, which were essential to writing the book. You know, in reading the day-by-day detectives' accounts, I don't think that was influenced by Tammany. The NYPD, rather, was coming out from Tammany's control. The first police commissioner picked from the ranks, who was, by all accounts, incorruptible. And so I think on a day-by-day basis, on the level of the detectives looking at the case, you know, I think they were trying to do their job as best as they could. I don't think it would have been impossible. I think it, for many reasons, it got off to a bad footing. And most importantly, it didn't go to the police department until almost a month after Crater was last seen in Manhattan. And that set the investigation back dreadfully.
Yeah.
You know, in all kinds of ways, looking at a month afterwards, the trail was cold. There was an effort to find out who was driving the cab that Crater got into on the night of August 6th. Maybe if the police had gotten it a day or two afterwards, they could have found the cab driver. As it was, a month later, they put out an ad, if you were the the cab driver, please come forward. And, you know, nobody came forward, of course. So in all kinds of little ways, the investigation was kind of in a hole from the start. The other thing that made the investigation difficult, and maybe we can discuss about this more, is Crater's activities on his last day, August 6th, were puzzling, extremely confusing. He seemed to be taking inconsistent, contradictory actions that day.
Absolutely.
I'd say just generally, the morning and early afternoon, everything, all signs showed to a voluntary disappearance, that he was fleeing. When you look at his activities that night in going to Broadway, I mean, that's not the kind of thing any sane person would want to do if he's really trying to disappear and go somewhere else and resume his life. You wouldn't go into an area that you were very well known, walk into a chop house that's kind of your regular haunt on Broadway.
Yeah.
Run into the proprietor who's a good friend of yours, try to get a ticket to a Broadway show playing that night. His activities later in the day and night suggest the opposite.
Yeah.
That he's going to stick around.
Yeah, I want to talk about August 6th because Chris and I talked about what was possibly going on in his head that day. And it's so hard to figure that out. Do you think he was maybe trying to be seen, like maybe trying to set up not necessarily an alibi, like maybe that's a strong word, but like if he had plans to leave or disappear or go do something or go be somewhere he shouldn't be, is there a possibility that maybe he wants to buy a ticket to a Broadway show so that then later someone will say he was at a Broadway show, even if he never intended to go pick up the ticket and go. But maybe it's kind of like a put people on the wrong scent kind of strategy.
Yeah, I need to be seen somewhere.
That could be.
He also seemed to not like being seen at the Chop House. That contradicts that though too, where the friend I recall that ran into him at the Chop House, William Klein, seemed to note that he was surprised to see his friends there and it was awkward. So I don't know.
That could be.
Same people, same place.
Right. He was awkward because two nights before, he and I think his girlfriend and her family ate with Crater at the same place. And that night, he told them all, "I'm out of here. I'm going back to Maine." You know, something very radical must have happened in those 2 days to get him to change. It could be he was trying to establish an alibi. In my conclusion, I don't want to give too much away. Maybe this is somewhat poetic justice. I think that maybe he was conflicted and his different behaviors reflected conflicts within himself about whether to flee or whether to stick around and face the music, so to speak, regarding the scandals that were breaking. I think it's impossible to get it in his head. But I did think that earlier that day, he made a comment to his deputy clerk when he was going to his apartment house with the clerk that really hadn't been picked up by the police or really any observers of the case, that he was maybe telegraphing to his deputy where he might expect he would be going to later that day in case he were to run into troubles up there, if that's where he indeed was going. It's specifically a comment about him going up to Westchester Way, which was a very kind of strange comment that stuck with the deputy, so that when the police interviewed him a month later, he said, oh yeah, he said this weird thing about going up to Westchester later that day. And there were some newspaper articles that he was going swimming. He told his clerk he was going swimming and he wasn't a big swimmer.
He wasn't a big swimmer. Okay.
As far as we know. So.
But did he go there often? Was there family, friends? Was that a place he was known to frequent?
In Westchester?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he really had no ostensible contacts. He did not have family. The only connection I could find was he was a member of the Larchmont Boat Club.
Okay.
That came out fairly early. And so the detectives went up there and questioned, you know, was he at this boat club, you know, back in August? And they all said no, they had no sign of him. But that was the only connection I could find until the butchers.
But you say butchers, and I think a lot of our audience is going to pick up on that. And they're going to be ordering, you know, definitely ordering the book.
Which I didn't, we didn't talk about that because I want to leave something. People need to go buy the
book. Right. I don't want to.
We definitely hope.
I hope so too.
The book is wonderful and it's a great exploration into this case. I did want to ask you about August the 5th, because Jen and I talked about that in what will now be episode 2 of the show. You know, we don't know necessarily what happened on August 5th. It's sort of a blank in the timeline. You talked a little bit about getting into the mindset of him, or maybe it's difficult to get into sort of what his line of thinking was in those last few moments or in those last few days. Do we have any idea what might have happened on August 5th that would have, for lack of a better term, made him freak out a little bit? I mean, it seemed like his behavior and his the way he changed, it happened within a 24-hour period. Do we know if he was threatened? Did something come to light that was, you know, he knew something was going to happen? I mean, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, there was one thing, and that's how I started the research, is just reading newspapers a month before he disappeared, right on through his disappearance.
Yeah.
And it gives you a very important chronology. The only thing that transpired that I can tell that would have really shaken him up was a breaking judicial scandal involving somebody very close to him, the district leader of the district club that Prater was a member of and who he was closely affiliated with. And there were stories actually breaking a few days earlier that the U.S. attorney, Charles Tuttle, had been investigating, who's no friend to Tammany Hall, by the way. He actually was very anti-Tammany. And they were investigating these new allegations that a magistrate judge 3 years before, who was also a member of the same district club as Crater and the district leader, had paid $10,000 to the district leader, a guy by the name of Martin Healy, which was appeared to be a payoff for his appointment to the magistracy by Mayor Walker.
Yeah.
Specifically in the what I think really brought it home to Crater. And I think that was the main reason he came back from Maine to the city in the first place, because the first reports of this breaking scandal. But by August 4th, the night of August 4th, the U.S. attorney, that's the federal government U.S. attorney, had decided that he couldn't prosecute what seemed to be an office buying of a municipal magistrate seat. On the night of August 4th, the U.S. attorney referred this investigation to the New York County district attorney by the name of Thomas C.C. Crane.
We love Thomas Crane. He's amusing.
Yeah. He was very rare within Tammany Hall, which was mainly composed and run by first generation Irish or Jewish or German immigrants who tended to be of lower socioeconomic status. Crane was descended from a very wealthy Protestant family that went back to the days of the Mayflower, I think.
Wow.
Was very wealthy. And how he came to find Tammany Hall, but anyway, he was a Tammany loyalist, a Tammany sachem wise man, as they were called. So anyway, the passing of this investigation from the feds essentially to the local prosecutor was key, because Prater and Healy, the district leader, and Tammany had very little influence with the U.S. attorney's office, which was on the federal level. They did have loads of influence on the Manhattan DA Crane. Mm. So I think it became clear to Crater, and possibly Healy asked him to intervene with the DA to kill this investigation. On the day of his disappearance, August 6th, on the front pages of all the papers, was Mayor Walker had suspended Healy, who also had a very high position in the city government, from his city position, saying that while such accusations are leveled against a member of his administration, he couldn't stay. He would be suspended until he was proven innocent. And for Mayor Walker to take that step, Mayor Walker was a childhood friend of Healy's. They had grown up together. They had always been very close. And for Mayor Walker to take such a public step as to remove him from his city administration,
yeah,
was huge. So anyway, that the whole Healy Ewald judge buying investigation, I think, was the major thing that Crater would have been involved in as a lawyer. Crater was referred to as the legal brains of Martin Healy. He was his, you know, from way back, from the last 10 years. So he would have been called in, I'm sure, by Healy for his influence, you know, on the DA's office. And from Crater's point of view, I think what was scary was he must have realized he could be a very, very material witness in this prosecution, because he was in the same district club as Martin Healy, the district leader, and Magistrate Ewald, and he was on very friendly terms with both. The appointment of Ewald was in 1927, and Crater had thrown a party for Ewald and Healy upon his assuming the magistracy seat. Huh. So he had his hands all over it.
Wow.
And I think what must terrified him was he could be a material witness.
Yeah. And that ties into, I guess, some of the theories that we'll discuss tonight. But I did want to sort of give you the floor to start this off and to talk a little bit about what you are theorizing, what you hypothesize happened. Tell us what you feel happened on August 6th, in the evening of August 6th. I mean, what is your thought process for that?
If you want to, if you don't want to, and you want to save it for people to buy the book, that's also fine.
Right. You could sort of go as long or as little as you want. It's up to you.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to keep the mystery going, but I can say, and I do in the introduction, that, and this is another reason why tracking him down, Crater down, was so difficult,
yeah,
is that the theories of Crater's disappearance fall into two camps.
Mm-hmm.
One is that he voluntarily disappeared,
mm-hmm,
either with a chorus girl or to flee some kind of scandal. And there are many more voluntary explanations for his disappearance. Then there are the involuntarily disappeared, that he was killed, the victim of random robbery, that he was bumped off by organized crime, that there's also probably five or six different theories of his involuntary appearance. And most students of the case kind of come down on one side or the other. I think in Crater's case, both were at work. Both the involuntary, the signs of his voluntary disappearance that day, and other things that strongly suggested his involuntary disappearance, they kind of merged in the explanation of what I think happened to Crater, because he was both trying to flee and he was involuntarily stopped from fleeing and disappeared. I think that just kind of created a bunch of confusion about the case from the start.
Yeah. Let me just ask you from a logistical standpoint, because we talked about this with Amelia Earhart, and we've talked about this certainly with John Wilkes Booth and some other very well-known faces. If he had staged his own disappearance, let's just say that's what happened, would it have been possible in that time for someone of his stature to relocate somewhere and never be heard from again? Is that a possibility?
Well, better chance than today, certainly.
Right.
Sure. But you're right. The odds were against it. And that's shown just by, say, his missing persons poster, which became iconic. Literally tens of thousands of copies of this were distributed in every post office and public gathering space on every ship. And just, he was a strange looking character to begin with. In addition, all this publicity that surrounded him because he was a sitting judge and a very prominent person, I would think the odds would be very unlikely that he could remain, you know, under a new identity
Right.
You know, there's some hypothesis that he went to Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody knew him in Australia. But I just think there would have been some sightings by people. I mean, as there were.
I was about to say, we have sightings. There were
huge number of yeah. sightings, all of them, which turned out to be false sightings. But if he had really done it, then especially with the reward that was offered during the first 3 or 4 years, I would think his odds of just quietly assuming a new life elsewhere would not have gotten to fruition.
Why do you think it is that most people in 2022 haven't heard of this case when it was so well known in 1930?
It's a good question.
That is a good question. It's bothered me throughout the writing the book and the publication of the book. I have some funny stories actually about that. It was known by everyone who was alive and sentient through the 1970s. I don't know if maybe the Hoffa disappearance kind of supplanted maybe. It.
Okay.
But it just, there were anyone who was alive, like I said, during those 3 or 4 decades after it would instantly notice it. I mean, even my parents, my dad was, well, he was born in 26. And so he was like a 4-year-old when he disappeared. But, you know, he was completely familiar, as were his parents. Just my generation, I guess, started just the news wasn't there. The jokes weren't there.
That's my favorite part of this whole thing. All the jokes.
But I've noticed, you know, I've gotten very intrigued with the publishing, the book publishing world versus the podcasts or the internet shows that have sprung up.
Yeah.
Just how, I mean, I'm fortunate that my book was published at a time when I think especially the millennial Generation Z, whatever, are really, really into these unsolved historical mysteries and true crime. I don't know if you've seen it, but BuzzFeed had a series, two guys, they seem to be kind of celebrities in the online world, two young guys, and they did something on the Crater case last summer.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it for this.
Yeah, it was actually one of the better ones, frankly. I was impressed by it, but I was more impressed that I just checked it the other day, 3.5 million viewers. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Well, we won't get that many listens. So.
Now, if only 1% of them went out and bought my book, I would be very happy. But their interest only seems to be to a certain level, that they're very curious. And it's almost like they post comments, like in this BuzzFeed one. You know, there were 1,000 different comments about it. And kind of each viewer expressing their opinion, you know, I think the butler did it, you know. It's kind of like a surface interest. I don't think, I don't know. I don't know the numbers on my sales at this point, but I don't think a lot of people in that market who are like transfixed by true crime, unsolved mysteries, want to go out and invest the time and money to read a book about it, to get a real understanding.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like only, like I said, a surface interest.
There is, but there's a subset of people that are like us, like me and Chris, that like we would like we have a lot of friends between the two of us that absolutely would love to dive deeper into it. So, I mean, I think that there is definitely a subset of true crime. I mean, I don't know what the right word for it is. I think obsession is strong.
Fascination.
That's a good word.
Like whenever you find, especially a new case that's not super well known and something that's unsolved, especially if there's like any chance at all that like there might be some clue that somebody missed or that you could figure it out. I think that's really true. Intriguing to people. Like people want to be part of something.
Yeah.
The whole cold case.
Yeah.
You know, looking at a new case again for, like you say, Jennifer, clues that were missed, you know.
Sure.
And there's that attraction. But it's just kind of, I'm finding it very interesting. I mean, I fortunately, you've taken an interest in the case, and there are some other podcasts and interviews I've done.
Yeah.
So I'm encouraged by that, but more people would read the damn book.
we certainly want to encourage that. I do want to ask you about a couple. I don't want to get like too far into like every theory, but I want to ask you about Toefel's theory. He seems to buy into had a heart attack while having sex with a prostitute and then was buried or thrown into the river theory.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on how plausible something like that. I mean, not maybe that specifically, but this idea that it just so happened that in the middle of everything going on and all of these things kind of converging on each other, he just happened into like a bad day where he slipped and fell or had an accident or died of natural causes. And I mean, to me, that seems highly unlikely. That seems like quite a coincidence if that's what happened. But I want to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Well, the theory that he died in a brothel has an interesting kind of genesis. And I think Toefel explains it. It comes from a book that Polly Adler wrote, who was the big madame at the time. Supposedly, she was with some big publishing house, and supposedly an editor or something was reading parts of her manuscript that were deleted from the final book for whatever reasons. And in there was something about this crater dying in the midst of having sex at this brothel. It's interesting, a new biography has come out about Polly Adler, which is very good. It's called Madame by Debbie Applegate, and I've kind of communicated with her. She had access to the notes and parts of the manuscript that were cut out from Polly Adler's book, because she located the ghostwriter, and ghostwriter was no longer alive, but her family said, hey, we have a box up in the attic. We don't know what to do with. And she went up there and it was all the parts of the manuscript.
Wow.
That's so cool.
She, saw the reference to crater, but she, from her book, just could not find anything to support it.
Okay.
And she knew a lot about Polly Adler. Like I say, it's a very good book. Probably enjoy it. It's called Madame, M-A-D-A-M, by Debbie Applegate. She traced Polly Adler's roots into some shtetl in Russia. I mean, that's how much research she did on this. And she couldn't find anything to the story that he died in her brothel while having sex.
Interesting.
And then, like you say, there's all these other things.
Yeah.
I mean, if there are very rational explanations of what could have caused it versus some just random happening, I think you tend to favor the rational explanation.
Sure.
Maybe that's just us as people want some reason for it as opposed to no reason. But I don't put any credence in him dying in the brothel.
I mean, that fits his MO. I mean, I feel like it kind of makes sense. Like that's how a guy like that would probably die. All this other stuff aside.
Oh, yeah.
So when someone says that, I can understand it.
Actually, I'm forgetting one slight detail which somewhat supports it. Polly Adler's, I didn't know at the time till I read her book.
Okay.
Polly Adler's main brothel was on West 54th Street.
Yeah.
So he disappeared from West 45th Street. He took a cab. Maybe you'd take a cab if you were going 10 blocks up to a brothel.
It's still kind of a stretch.
It is.
But that's the only bit of evidence I could find.
I mean, I guess you never know. We talked in episode 2 about this phone call that Crater makes when he's out with Stella. He goes out and he makes a phone call, and then he all of a sudden tells his wife, hey, I gotta go back to town. I gotta go take care of some stuff.
Needs to go back to New York.
So I have hypothesized that was likely Healy calling him. Do we have any information on that, or do we know who that was on the other line?
No. The police, for whatever reason, I don't know if they had the capability,
sure,
but they never investigated if they could trace what, again, I don't know if tracing was what it is now, but they did not, never looked at it. I agree with you. I think it was either Healy or Ewald or one of his henchmen. But the interesting thing about the phone call was, in reading articles, there was a major article in Collier's in 1950, and then another one in a major magazine in 1960. They talked about Crater receiving a call at his cabin. Mm-hmm. And that's what drove him back.
Right.
So I think I found out from Stella's memoirs, their cabin had no phone.
Right.
In other words, the only phone in town was in Belgrade Lakes Village.
Yeah.
So in other words, it had to be initiated by Crater. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like somebody called them up and right. said, get down here, where it would be more obvious. So I started looking like, why would he call?
Yeah.
After just coming up to Maine.
Just got there, yeah.
The day before, what's would be so important that he's starting his vacation? And like the second day, you know, he has to make a call. I don't even know if they know it was a call to New York specifically. I don't think they even traced that.
Okay.
He just made a call. So you got to think what was so important to him that on the second day of his vacation, he has to make a call. Just the fact that he says, I have to go back to New York, strongly suggests the call was from New York. If you put that together, right after the call, he tells Stella, I have to straighten some folks out. And then the next day takes a train back to New York.
Yeah.
You know, I think the call had to be to somebody in New York.
When he didn't show up for the first day of term, one of the other judges on the panel calls Belgrade Lakes looking for Stella, or maybe even the judge. And then I guess Stella is given, you know, she's notified of this, and then she calls him back from the phone in Belgrade Lake. So I've always wondered if maybe something like that happened, or maybe somebody sent a telegram, or like somehow he got wind that somebody needed to talk to him. And so then he goes and makes that phone call.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it was, I guess, at their summer place. Apparently the only phone, or the main one, was in town. And you're right, when you got a call, somebody called the line, like one of the judges did with Stella. They ran to her cabin and said, you got a call down in the center of town. And she went down there, and that's how they talked. So it could have been something that prompted. There's no record that he got a telegram, or Stella says that he got it in. And again, this is like literally less than a day.
Yeah.
Since he drove up, you know, so there had to be something on his mind that was very, very pressing.
Yeah.
I don't think it could have been something flip, like, you know, somebody calls and there's a party, you know, at the Cayuga Club. You got to come down. I mean, it just had to be something more important.
Do you think the case is solvable? Like, do you think that one day you or somebody else is going to be able to figure out definitively what happened? Or is it always going to be a mystery?
I think the only way it could possibly be solvable would be finding.
We need a body. Yeah.
All the witnesses are long dead. Nobody has personal knowledge. If, say, the body was found somewhere that had connections to other bits of the evidence, that to me would be a solution. But if you can't find the body, you know, I think there's a slight possibility that he could be buried up in Westchester. But somebody finds his body in New Orleans, then there's another bit of reasons why.
It's going to be a sequel to this book.
It's going to be a sequel to this book, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the last questions I have personally is, what would you like to see happen next in this case? You know, I always ask that for everybody who comes on the show. Where do you think we should be concentrating our resources? What would you like to, if you had absolute power and you could wake up tomorrow and say, okay, I'm in charge of this investigation, where do you go? What do you do first?
One bit of evidence that I didn't get access to, might it be helpful, is they still have the grand jury transcripts from the grand jury back in 1930. And I know the police have them because I did make a FOIL requests, Freedom of Information Law,
sure,
in New York. The DA's office said protected by grand jury secrecy. And there's other reason to believe that they do have them,
yeah,
the transcripts. I think that might provide a lot of, maybe some additional information. The reason why it may not be so key is, again, because the DA, Thomas Crane, ran the grand jury. And there's suggestions that I've found that he really didn't want to get
a lot of interest,
and that he didn't, for example, Healy and his brother were both called before the Crater grand jury and had to give up immunity. From the newspaper accounts, at least, very cursory questioning of the Healys. When I think, you know, I think there were all kinds of questions they could ask Martin Healy that would be of interest. They just asked about these phone calls that Stella Crater placed at the end of August to Healy's summer house, which were where I found very telling, and really, I think, helped me come to the conclusion I came to. She basically called in the middle of the night, hysterical, didn't get Martin Healy. And this was at a time at the end of August when she came back before her husband's disappearance had broken the story. And she was just trying to locate him. So Healy's brother was called in. He said, I picked up the phone, and she kind of shrieked, "Where's my husband? Where's my husband? Mm-hmm. Are you protecting him?" Healy's brother, William Healy, said in the grand jury she sounded like her husband had just died. Which I thought was, whether Healy's brother knew about it, you know, they weren't, it was his younger brother. I don't think probably Martin would have confided in his younger brother if he was really behind, but it was an interesting reaction of the brother saying, she sounded like her husband just died.
Yeah.
And I don't think he said that from any personal knowledge,
sure, yeah,
but just from the tone of her voice and what she was asking, you know.
Wow. Well, you know, we're talking about this at the end of episode 2. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the grand jury issuing what I consider to be like a bombshell statement. It's just like, hey, there's nothing here. We have no evidence that's sufficient to say anything, essentially. And then you have the Healy and the Ewalds resulting in hung juries, and, you know, the government dropping the cases or dismissing the cases. It feels like this story just ends in a whole lot of nothing.
Unsatisfying ending for everything.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's kind of a sad ending in a way. I mean, until something does happen or something changes potentially, maybe in the future. I feel like it's kind of a sad ending. I mean, nobody wins here. I mean, everybody loses, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, it's very frustrating. And
I bet. I bet.
And like I said, I don't think it'll be solved ever. What I found most interesting, and again, I have degrees in history and was thinking of being a history professor at one time. Part of the reason why I got back to writing this was just the history of New York City in the 1920s.
Yeah.
The Crater disappearance was kind of emblematic of bigger changes in New York. And I try to get at that by showing the importance of his disappearance to the election of Franklin Governor Roosevelt to a second term and to the fall of Tammany Hall.
Yeah.
So it was really, he kind of vanished into nowhere at the very time his New York City was vanishing into nowhere. It was kind of symptomatic of these larger changes to New York City government, business, law practice, to the nightlife. He was kind of the epitome of this old New York, which I didn't really know about. And I was totally fascinated with the whole Manhattan in the 1920s and the Jazz Age, or, you know, Prohibition, organized crime. His passing was kind of, like I said, was emblematic of deeper changes in New York City. You know, Tammany Hall was, this was kind of the first blow to Tammany. After which were the Seabury Committee's findings and his, Mayor Walker being resigning in 1932. Mm-hmm. Then you have Mayor LaGuardia coming in 1934, who's anti-Tammany, anti-corruption, and the whole New Deal, the public works, and the social welfare benefits that used to be supplied by Tammany to its members now being taken over by the government on different levels. So I kind of saw that as sort of picturesque ending to the whole story. I kind of put my historian's cap on and stepped away from the true crime.
Yeah.
And as I say at the end, if he had come back in 6-7 years, the New York City he had known and loved and been so successful in was gone. He wouldn't have recognized it. It would have been like he was in a foreign city. And I think a lot of the New York City that he loved was gone forever.
Wow.
You know, even if he did come back, it was almost too late to testify because Tammany was already on its way out. And you had a few big trials of Tammany, the district leader from Harlem. You know, he kind of would have served no purpose by coming back. And he would have served a huge purpose if he was able to come back shortly after his disappearance. There's always a side of Crater that, you know, he was corrupt, he had mistresses, you know, all kinds of faults. But a lot of the people who knew him thought he was a brilliant lawyer and that he had a lot of upstanding values. One of the theories is that, and this may be why he was ultimately silenced, is that he wasn't going to be the scapegoat. He was the type of guy that was a fighter. And if he had to, you know, help investigators or become a witness in a big corruption trial against Tammany, that he would have really done that. And if he had done that, that fall, I think all hell would have broken loose. Maybe not only in the gubernatorial election, the ramifications would have been really, really big that fall or the spring after. But he never got that chance. And so a lot of it's just speculation. He was a difficult man to get. It was difficult for me to get inside of his head. He had no children. His wife, by the time I looked into it, was long gone, and she was protective of his reputation anyway. He was a loving husband and, you know, upright man. I couldn't imagine him. And since most of the people close to him were dead by the time I started, in a lot of ways, he was a real cipher. Even his kind of contemporaries said he was a chameleon. He was in all these different worlds in New York City, you know, the legal world, the political world, the nightlife world. I got some little things that he was a glad hander, that he loved to tell jokes and kind of
like the center of attention, center of the party.
Yeah. Good guy.
Star of the show.
Yeah. And it was difficult for me to just try to get inside his head. If he had children or a family, you know, there's at least maybe if there were some papers that would help, but all of that was gone by the time I started looking into it.
You know, having written the book now, looking back in retrospect and all the research you've done, and earlier you saying that likely that the case won't be solved, are you content in that? I mean, as a researcher, that must be difficult for someone who really, you know, looks into a case and puts enough time into it to write a book. I know that firsthand now. Are you content with not knowing?
I mean, sure, I'd like to know, but I think I take a lot of pride in the book in that it's what I set out to do.
Yeah. You know,
and what I've hopefully achieved is just setting down for the record all the to give a comprehensive account of the case, even mm-hmm. if it's ultimately, you know, unsolvable. I think I was able to do that. There was nothing really like my book. There's no other really comprehensive account. Toffel's was not, you know, really about the crater disappearance so much as the Seabury investigations and what was, you know, what led to Mayor Walker's resigning. I've given, if nothing else, a foundation, a solid foundation of the evidence and the facts of the case. Like I said, at the beginning, when I started, there were all these theories, but there was none that seemed to have any precedence over the others in terms of the, and I found that mind-boggling. There was no one or two theories that were more plausible than all the others.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a real challenge. And the other purpose of my book was to sift through all the evidence, even from, you know, years later. The best chance to solve it was in the 1950s. And for various reasons, I say in the book, it was blown, the one opportunity. But I think at least I've gone through all the evidence, including that which came out 25 years after, 30 years after.
Yeah.
And really seen where the evidence logically points. I mean, I've always kind of looked at it as a puzzle, piecing together all the bits of evidence and to come to some conclusion that's plausible and credible, which at least the Wall Street Journal review, I don't know if you saw it, but my book said that I give a credible explanation of what happened to him. So I think that's an advancement rather than just speculation.
Yeah.
Yes. He could have run off with a mistress. He could have, you know, that all these explanations that are equally plausible or implausible. So I like to think I've at least accomplished that.
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be a sequel, like,
maybe. We hope. We hope. Well, I highly encourage anyone listening to read the book because, I mean, we do talk about, we rely on it a lot because, as you said, there really isn't a whole lot out there that actually gives that evidence. And so we do rely heavily on it when we're telling the story here. But, I mean, we don't even, there's so much that we're not able to cover
so much
in the podcast. And so, like, I think that if you've enjoyed this series, you should definitely go check out Stephen's book. And so why don't you tell everybody where they can find it?
Pretty much on Amazon. Most Barnes & Noble, I know, carries it. Even it's listed in Walmart,
nice. Believe it or not.
You know you've made it.
But I think any, you know, books that
we'll have a link to in our show notes if you want to just use that. But yeah, you just go on Amazon. It's called Finding Judge Crater, A Life and Phenomenal Disappearance in Jez Age in New York. And it's fantastic. And you can find out what is honestly probably the most likely scenario, or at least the best one that I've seen. So yeah, and tell us what you think if you read it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And we will, as Jen said, have links to the book in the show notes for tonight's episode. Stephen, thank you so much for doing this. I mean, we appreciate having you.
Thank you so much for joining. This was fun.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I want to thank everyone for going on this unexpected journey with us. We never intended to start season 3 with this case, but I'm very glad that we did. Judge Crater's case does not get the attention that it deserves. And so, I'd also like to thank Steve Regal for coming on our show, sharing his thoughts with us, but especially for writing his book. I learned a lot from reading it, and I encourage all of you to go grab a copy and read it as well. I promise you won't be disappointed. Meanwhile, Chris and I are packing our bags and leaving the East Coast. We're headed all the way to the other side of the country, to the San Francisco Bay Area, where in the late 1960s, at least 5 people were murdered by a man in a mask. This man would later confess his crimes in anonymous phone calls, in scrawled writing on the side of his victim's vehicle, and in letters that he wrote to the media for years. But then one day, he vanished. We don't know if he was killed, if he was arrested, or if he moved. But we do know that he gave himself a name. So join us next time as Chris and I investigate the Zodiac Killer.
This is Chris Williamson. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishedpod, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. The show is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Chris Evan Films production. All rights reserved.